The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the simplest, most powerful website creator that helps you make headlines with your own stunning online presence. Explore elegant templates, Getty image integration, and more at squarespace.com, and use the code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Coming up on the show, we'll look at the science behind our sense of touch. Neuroscientist David J. Linden has been reimagining the hierarchy of the human body and argues that touch is the sense which defines us as humans, intrinsically linking with our emotions and shaping our sense of self. We'll talk to David about how we can change our brain's touch maps, how to give the perfect caress, and what on earth can we do about itching. Plus, geneticists reveal another sex scandal in Richard III's family tree, and how crossing your fingers can help you feel less pain. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. David J. Linden is Professor of Neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. His new book is called Touch: The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. In the book, David suggests that touch's intrinsic emotional importance to humans is shown by its presence in our language. For instance, we describe someone who's emotionally clumsy as tactless. Literally, they lack touch. He goes on to show why he considers touch our most important sense, that shapes our sense of self and bonds us together. I started by asking David why he wanted to write about this particular subject.
I'm always looking for scientific stories that are compelling, that describe something essential about what it's like to be human. And so the sense of touch seemed like an obvious choice because it is such an intrinsically emotional phenomenon. It motivates so much of our behavior. And the other reason is that there's been enormous progress in touch science in the recent 15 years, and the story hasn't been told.
You start off the book by talking about how this childhood game from back in the day where people were asking each other sort of, you know, various questions. And one of the questions was, what sense would you do without? And people will often say, you know, of all of the senses I would give up, touch would be the one that they would give up. And is it because touch is almost belittled that we take it for granted? And are we right to actually see it as a lesser sense?
I think the reason is that because we can't imagine not having it. So we can all shut our eyes and imagine being blind or plug our ears or pinch our nose closed. But touch is an always-on sense. And unless you are one of the very few people who has a genetic disease where touch sensation has been lost, you can't imagine being without it. And as a consequence, I think that leads us to take it for granted.
You said something very surprising early on in the book, which is that if people are born or early on, they don't have sight, they lose their hearing or what have you, they can carry on and develop normally and have rich and fulfilling lives and so on. But with touch, it's different, that you say that if you don't have touch early on or throughout your early development, then it can actually have a more profound impact on you. It seems you're saying.
That's correct. And actually, it's not just any touch, it's interpersonal touch. So we're not talking about people who lack touch sensation biologically. But we know this primarily, although not exclusively, from the orphanages in Romania that resulted from the Ceausescu population expanding policies. And so there developed orphanages that were grossly understaffed, and children who basically didn't receive any loving touch at all through the first 2 years of their life. And these kids developed rocking, compulsive, self-soothing motions, and they had attachment disorders, cognitive delays. And the problems weren't just limited to the realm of the brain. They actually would grow more slowly and have problems with the development of the immune system and the gastrointestinal system. And the terrible thing was that if intervention with loving touch didn't come in the first 2 years of life, then these effects would linger throughout life. And as adults, these people had much higher incidence of depression, schizophrenia, mental retardation, diabetes, immune system disorders. So touch, unlike other senses, is not optional for early human development. And in particular, it needs to be loving touch, interpersonal touch.
When I was reading that section about the Romanian orphanages, and we remember those stories very well, I wondered how you could know that it was social touch that was the issue. Because obviously these children growing up in these orphanages were deprived of many, many things, and social touch being one of them, but also there would have been other issues going on there. And I'm wondering how you tease apart the factors and are able to say that social touch is the one or the significant one.
That's a great question, because obviously these kids were malnourished as well and had a number of problems. The reason that we can say this comes from intervention studies. So some of these kids were lucky enough to have caregivers who came in. Really, their nutrition and their general health needs weren't being met to, but they were being touched for half an hour a day. And when that happened, if it happens early enough in life, it can rescue these both psychiatric and somatic developmental problems.
So what do you think is actually causing that? How is social touch enabling a child to thrive, if you like, whereas the lack of it is causing some kind of developmental problem?
So I wish I could give you a biochemical pathway that went from receptors in the skin and then explained this aspect of how it affects human development. But unfortunately, we don't know that. We know some very general things. We know, for example, a very analogous phenomenon happens in newborn rats. And there are some rat mothers who will lick and groom their pups a lot, and others that will lick and groom their pups very infrequently. And we know that this isn't heritable. So you can cross-foster. If you take a rat from a low licking grooming mother and place it in the brood of a high licking grooming mother, then they will grow up as if they had high licking grooming. And we know that the difference between this maternal care changes what we call epigenetics. That is to say, it doesn't actually alter the genetic code, but rather it changes certain marks on genes or on proteins that are associated with genes that alter how these genes are expressed. Now, that is a very general explanation, but as we are able to dig into that in more detail and understand the patterns of differential gene expression, I think that will eventually give us a more detailed answer to your question.
Presumably, that's a kind of difficult run of experiments to do, because you're immediately into interesting ethical territory that I can't imagine you're going to get sort of ethical approval for a study where you say, okay, we're going to take a bunch of 200 two-year-olds and 100 of them will get normal care and the others will leave in, you know, we'll deprive. Is this going to be confined to sort of lower animal studies?
I think it will, yes. This isn't the sort of thing that anyone should be doing with humans or I believe even with non-human primates. This is the sort of stuff that should be done with mice and rats.
It's interesting, though, because in history there have been times when parents have been advised to have fairly minimal contact with their children, to just pat them on the head if they do something exceptional, kiss them on the forehead at most when they go to sleep at night, shake their hand in the morning, and none of this sort of more normal sort of loving behavior that out of fear of making them spoiled.
That's right. In particular, when the psychological movement known as behaviorism was in full swing in the early part of the 20th century, there were people who wrote child-rearing guides that advised just that, basically to treat your children like little adults. We now know that that's actually a disastrous idea.
But there's other things that come along sort of in the contemporary world that can have maybe not as dramatic an effect, but still impinge on this idea of children may not be getting the sort of same kind of contact with adults that they have in the past out of fears of inappropriate behavior and all these sorts of things which often get sort of whipped up by the media.
I think this is very true. And we have, in many cases, no-touch policies for teachers or sports coaches, for example, and you can understand there are real reasons why these policies were developed out of fear of sexual predators and abuse. And these are real fears and should be taken seriously. But the problem is that the abusers just ignore these rules anyway, and the effect winds up being that what you ban is appropriate social touch. What you ban is the good teacher wanting to give their child in their classroom a hug to encourage them, or an arm around the shoulder from a coach to encourage that play. And what we know is that not just with children, but with everyone, is that appropriate social touching is social glue. It's what binds sexual partners into lasting couples. It binds people in the community and creates bonds of trust and cooperation. It's basically a signal that says, I'm on your side, I'm not a threat. And when we have policies that make that impossible, there's a price to pay.
You talk in the book about how our brains have these touch maps and that they're larger for certain parts of our bodies than for others, like for our hands and for our feet and so on like that. What if you could explain why that is so? I mean, maybe it's obvious, but it'd be good to check. And whether they are things which are sort of set and defined fairly early on in life and they remain so for the rest of your life.
Yes. So if we look in the part of the brain called the somatosensory cortex, which is involved in processing not the emotional aspects of touch, but the rather factual, discriminative aspects of touch. Where in my body am I being touched? In what fashion? How intensively? There are several maps of the human body, and they're not accurate maps. So if you were to look at these maps, and I think many of your readers have seen these reproduced, the lips are very large, and the fingers are very large, and the tongue is very large, but areas like the small of the back and the thighs are relatively tiny. And this represents the density of particular kinds of nerve endings called Meissner endings and Merkel endings, which are fine touch mechanical sensation receptors. For example, you might think, well, we know our fingertips are very sensitive, and we can use them to do something that requires tactile acuity, like reading braille dots. And we can do that with our lips or our tongue as well, if necessary, because they also have lots of these particular Merkel endings, which are most important. But we might think, well, but there are other areas of the body that are very sensitive to touch. Let's say the cornea of the eye or the skin of the genitals. Both of these areas can respond to a very tiny deflection of the skin. You know that if you get a little bit of grit in your eye, that you can detect that very, very strongly. But think about that grit in your eye. It hurts like crazy, but you can't tell exactly where in your eye it is. It's what we call protopathic sensation. And that's because there are no Merkel endings there. The same is true with your genitals. If you try to read Braille with your genitals, and your readers can wait until there's no one at the cash point and have a try at this if they like, they will fail. Because there are no Merkel endings there. So it is sensitive, but not discriminative. Now, it turns out you asked, can these areas change as a result of experience? And they can. So we know, for example, that if you practice violin 3 hours a day, your fingering hand, its representation within the somatosensory cortex will expand slightly. And then if you quit violin, it will slowly contract. Women, when they are nursing a baby, the representation of their nipple will expand while they're nursing as a result of that tactile sensation, and it will contract again when they are no longer nursing. So our brains are plastic, but they're not infinitely plastic. They're plastic within a certain set of constraints.
And what happens with people who lose limbs and so on? Do they have parts of those maps actually get sort of disappear and get subsumed into other parts of the body and so on?
They do, and the degree to which that can happen depends upon the age at which you lose it. So if you lose, say, a digit very early in life, then your surrounding digits will be able to take over that part of the unused part of the brain rather easily. When you are older, it takes longer and it is less complete. But yes, ultimately speaking, areas of the brain that are disused tend to get colonized. It can even happen across senses. So for example, people who are blind at birth from damage to the eye, the visual parts of their brain then get taken over by non-visual functions.
You're talking earlier about how certain parts of skin on the body can detect very tiny deflections. It made me realize we haven't really talked about what touch is in terms of what it's actually being detected on the skin. And I had kind of assumed that it was something to do with deflection of hairs and having some kind of mechanical sort of action on the skin down at the sort of follicle level. But is there actually some sort of strain gauge type system going on in our skin as well? I mean, what are the processes actually at the skin level?
Well, it turns out there are very many of them all in parallel, and they're a little bit different on the skin that has hairs, which is most of our body, than it is on the hairless or glabrous skin of our palms or lips, for example. It's not just mechanical sensors. So we have separate sensors in the skin for heat and cold. cold and pain and itch and sexual sensation. And then in addition, we have four different kinds of mechanical sensation in hairless skin. One for fine form, the Merkel that I mentioned earlier. We have another ending called a Meissner that's there for detecting microscopic slips between objects in our skin. So if you pick up a glass of water, you grab it just hard enough so that it doesn't fall out of your hands, but not so hard that you crush it. And that is a reflex, a subconscious reflex that is produced by these slip detecting Meissner endings. We have a skin stretching detector called a Ruffini, and we have a high-frequency vibration detector called a Pacinian. Of course, all of these are named after the 19th century anatomists who first described them. And just as you said, in hairy skin, we have nerve endings that wrap around the base of hair follicles. Some of them wrap all the way around like a lasso. Some of them wrap halfway around like a half moon. And these are the ones that allow us to detect directional hair deflection. So that's the reason why having your arm caressed with the grain of your hairs feels different than it does when you're caressed against the grain of your hairs.
You talk in the book about how our sense of touch can be very sophisticated, and I was wondering if you can kind of communicate emotions through touch.
Well, it turns out that communicating specific emotions only through touch is very, very limited. So there is a fellow in the USA named Matthew Hertenstein, and he did these experiments where he asked people, he gave them a list of 15 or 20 emotions and asked them to convey them through touches on the arm with someone whose arm was like coming around a barrier. So there were no cues. They couldn't see, hear any sounds or see any facial expressions. And the answer is you could convey a few, but it was very crude. But the truth is, we don't experience touch in isolation. We don't experience very many senses in isolation at all. We're used to combining them and putting information together. A great example comes from an illusion called the parchment hands illusion. So if you rub your hands together, there's a very subtle, dry, raspy sound that happens. And if you put people in an experiment where they have headphones, very tightly sealing headphones on their ears, and a microphone that's pointed at their hands, and they can hear those sounds, if those sounds are conveyed accurately, they might rate their hands as being moderately dry. But if you process that sound and manipulate it to accentuate the high frequencies, then they rate the touch of their hands as being extremely dry. And this is because we are hardwired to combine these auditory and tactile cues together in making a decision.
You were talking early on in the book about how we use language of feeling and touch in our normal everyday language, which maybe suggests how widespread and brought into our language touch is. So with touch, you have this strange thing whereby the same kind of stimulus, if you like, the same kind of touch can be incredibly distressing and threatening, depending on the environment, on the situation, or the absolute opposite end of the spectrum.
I mean, this is something that's true of all of our senses, but it's particularly true of touch. What we experience is entirely dependent upon context and expectation. And this isn't surprising. Imagine if you like coffee and tea both, and you were expecting coffee in your mug and you pick it up and there's tea. Well, your reaction to that is very different than if you were expecting tea in your mug. Now, imagine this. Imagine you're with your sweetheart and it's a quiet, connected time. You're feeling very loving and your sweetheart strokes your arm and it feels really nice. Now imagine the very same stroke of your arm, exactly in the same place, with the same pressure, the same physical aspects from the same person, but now in the middle of an unresolved argument. It feels coercive and like an insect and bad. It's not that it feels the same, but then upon reflection, you think of it differently. It actually, in the very first moment, feels different. And that is because higher areas of the brain involved in context and social cognition are sending signals to the somatosensory cortex, which is processing the discriminative information about touch and is altering that perception.
And giving you the full picture of what's going on rather than just taking in its sort of singularity that one sort of thing.
Well, I think this is a crucial point, and that is we like to think our senses can give us unbiased, truthful information about the external world, and that we can make decisions in an entirely rational way based on that. And that's utter nonsense. We're not driving the bus. By the time we are aware of a sensation, that sensation has already been filtered and edited and combined with our expectations and our emotions and our personal history. So in the end, there is no sensation without emotion. There is no sensation without personal history, without evolutionary history. It's all combined into a mush, and that's what we have to deal with.
In the experiments that you do and the research you read up on, do any differences between men and women come out? Do we have very much the same kind of systems operating at the same levels?
Well, in some ways, it's remarkably similar. So, for example, if you put a man, a woman in a brain scanner and have them experience an orgasm, the pattern of brain activation and deactivation in different regions is remarkably similar between the two, surprisingly so. However, if you get 1,000 women and have them come into the lab and you have them see the finest spatial form they can determine on their fingertips, and 1,000 men, you find on average the women do better than the men. And you might think, oh, well, maybe women have softer skin and it indents more easily, and that's the reason. No, that's not the reason. But then if you look at the data, something interesting occurs. If you look carefully, what you see is that the women who happen to have unusually large fingers do about the same as your average man. The men who have unusually small fingers do about the same as your average woman. And so while there are, on the average, differences between men and women, these are entirely attributable to finger size. It seems as if we have a fixed number of fine touch receptors of Merkel endings on the fingertip. And if you've got a bigger fingertip, then those endings are spread out and there are larger gaps in between them, which slightly degrades our very best acuity. Interestingly, this happens in other areas of the body. So breasts, for example, it turns out that there are a fixed number of tactile receptors on the areola. So women with larger breasts, who tend to have larger areolas, have slightly worse tactile discrimination than women with smaller breasts and smaller areolas.
Which must cause havoc in breastfeeding time because they're changing.
Havoc
may be a bit strong.
I don't think there's really havoc. I think it works just fine. But we do know that during breastfeeding that the representation of the nipple does indeed expand.
Before we go, I did want to ask you about itching, which seems to be something of a mystery in science. But I wonder, what does your work tell you about what itching is and what can be sort of done about that?
This has changed just in the last few years, and much of it is from work done by a colleague of mine at Johns Hopkins named Xinzhong Dong. So there's been an argument in both neuroscience and psychology for years about whether itching is really at its heart a unique sensation or whether it is merely a pattern of activation of, say, pain receptors. Maybe it's just like a little pain mixed with a little bit of light touch, and that's what itch is. But yet, we experience itch as a very unique phenomenon. It compels scratching in a way that other sensations don't. For the very first time, Xinzhong's lab has found there is indeed a unique nerve ending in the skin that transduces itch. Now, that's interesting not just from an academic reason, because if you've ever gotten, say, poison oak or poison ivy or some other irritant, plant irritant on your skin, you know that the creams that you can get from a dermatologist are not very effective at relieving the itch. Now that we have the molecular target for itch neurons, we will be able to develop anti-itch therapies that are much, much better.
Just so I don't leave everybody itching, I'm going to ask one more. And that is just if there is a little trick or anything that you've learned from your research that we can do on ourselves or on our friends to just maybe teach us something a bit about touch, something unusual.
I would say one of the most important things that we can do is to be attentive to the precise aspects of caress. When you're trying to give someone a friendly touch or a loving touch, we know that if you move the hand very slow, it doesn't feel loving, and if you move it very fast, it doesn't feel loving. But there's an intermediate speed and an intermediate pressure that feel really good, and it's about 2 inches per second. So if you're looking to perform the ideal caress, those are the parameters you want.
Is there a pressure as well we should be aware of?
Yes. So if you press really hard, that's not good. And if you press very, very lightly, again, that doesn't feel loving. And it turns out that this ideal caress is encoded in the electrical properties of the C tactile caress sensor nerve ending, which wraps around the base of hairs. So first of all, caresses are not really very effective on hairless skin like the palm of the hand, but they're effective in on the cheek or the back of the arm where skin is hairy, and you want to use an intermediate pressure and intermediate speed.
David J. Linden, and Touch is published now by Viking.
Guardian listeners get the latest news, but they can also create it. With our sponsor Squarespace, you can easily create an elegant website for your personal brand, online store, business, personal portfolio, or blog. Whoever you are, Squarespace's simple tools and elegant designs make your ideas newsworthy and accessible to any audience. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian science correspondent Hannah Devlin joins me now. Hannah, what caught your eye in the news this week?
Well, I'm interested in the update on the royal sex scandal. So this is a story about Richard III and his descendants. A group of geneticists have been testing various modern-day descendants of Richard III, and the prime purpose was to establish that the skeleton that had been found was indeed the king. And the first thing that they found was relatives descended down the female line did indeed match up with Richard III's mitochondrial DNA. So that made them confident that they did have the remains of Richard III. When it came to the male line, the findings were a bit more interesting. They found by testing various descendants of Henry Somerset that none of these descendants actually matched the Y chromosome of Richard III. So what this means is that somewhere along the family tree, there'd been a false paternity event. That is, a king might have been cuckolded somewhere along the line. Now, it's important to point out that there were about 19 joins between these modern day relatives and Richard III. And to complicate matters, Richard III didn't have any grandchildren, so they had to trace backwards in time all the way up to Edward III in the 1300s, and then back forward through the houses of Lancaster and Tudor to the present day. So if it was that the false paternity event occurred somewhere close to the present day, then it might be interesting to the direct descendants, but it's probably not going to change British history. What would be really interesting is if the break occurred somewhere close to Richard III. So one example would be Richard III's paternal grandfather, the Earl of Cambridge. There were some suspicions around at the time that there could have been infidelity in that family, and that would potentially cast doubts on Richard III's claim to the throne. I believe there's been some new tests of a new relative who's alive today, and I'm intrigued by what this tells us about this story.
Yes, so to take the story on, the geneticists led by Turi King at University of Leicester were approached by a chap who lives in France called Patrice de Warren. Now, Patrice de Warren can trace his male line ancestry, or claims to be able to trace his male line ancestry, back to a guy called Geoffrey, Count of Anjou. And he lived 200 years before Edward III. And so Edward III comes down the male line from Geoffrey. And from Edward III, the family tree sort of splits out into one branch that goes down to Henry Somerset, 5th Duke of Beaufort, and that kind of bunch. And the other side comes down through to Richard III. Now, all of these guys should have the same Y chromosome because the Y chromosome is passed down the male line, and so it shouldn't change very much in between all of those. So it should be, if they're all related, then the Y chromosome should be the same. Now, we've already found, like what you were saying earlier, Hannah, was that the descendants of Henry Somerset, who are around today, anonymous, their Y chromosomes didn't match the Y chromosomes of Richard III, so there's some break in the chain there. Now, what the researchers were hoping was if they could get a match between Patrice de Warren, who's alive and well, if they could get a match between his Y chromosome and either the Somersets or Richard III, they'd be able to narrow down a little bit which branch of the family tree this non-paternity event happened.
So what did they find?
Well, unfortunately, they found Patrice de Warren's Y chromosome doesn't match anyone else's Y chromosome not out of those two groups either. So his Y chromosome doesn't match that of Richard III, and it doesn't match that of the Somersets. So it shows that there's been another adulterous affair at some point in this family. Now, there are something like 20 and more generations between Geoffrey, Count of Anjou, and Patrice de Warenne. So the break in that chain could be anywhere. They don't know where it is. But it's always fun to speculate on these things. And if it happened to be right near the top of that tree, it's unlikely just by the pure numbers game. But if it happened to be right near the top of that tree, it could affect all of the guys from Henry II down, which is essentially the whole sort of House of Plantagenet. So this starts really kicking around with British sort of monarchy history, even though it doesn't have any sort of implications for Queenie. It does change the history a bit. Now, it's probably not going to happen. And the tricky thing now becomes is how do you find out more? Now, there are more de Warrens alive and well that the researchers want to test. There are also some members of the extended family of Henry Somerset, this fifth Duke of Beaufort, who are kind of lost in history, but there's some more sort of descendants of them. I think some of them are in Australia, some of them in the US, which are worth tracking down to see if they can get any leverage on the question there. But probably the only other way they're going to solve it is to dig up an awful lot of people and do the testing, which probably isn't on the cards, Hannah, is it?
Not that I know of. Although one historian I spoke to was actually quite keen to exhume remains and just put this question to rest permanently.
Why do you think we're all so fascinated by this? You know, Richard III was on the throne for a couple of years. You know, he wasn't the most sort of impactful king that England has had.
I suppose it's our fascination first with royalty, that whatever we say, we probably do expect them to behave differently.
We expect them actually to behave worse than the normal people. And the researchers said actually they expected, this was no surprise finding another kind of infidelity in the family, because they said about every generation you expect 1-2% a sort of chance of the father not being who he thinks he is.
Well, I suppose these are a monumental historical events as well that have changed the course of our country, and it's interesting to know that maybe not everyone was who we thought they were.
Anyway, Richard III was buried for the second time on Thursday. Let's see, maybe we'll see more of his relatives being dug up in the near future to find out really what happened in that family. Hannah, your next story was something to do with how crossing your fingers can help you feel less pain or something like that.
Yes, so this is some research coming from University College London. They're looking at how the brain processes different sensations from your fingers. To do the experiment, they've used quite a clever trick, which I'm actually going to try and demonstrate for you now. to start off with, this is just about hot and cold. It's something called the thermal grill illusion. If you put your index finger and your ring finger in a cup of warm water, and then you put your middle finger in a cup of really, really cold water, your brain does this funny thing where it doesn't interpret the middle finger as being cold. It interprets it as being even hotter than the other two. And some people even find this painful. So I've actually brought along two Guardian mugs, with one with warm water, one with icy cold water, and I'm going to test it out on you, Ian.
I haven't done this before. I didn't want to have any kind of prior expectation of what was going to happen. So yeah, we've got a mug
warm,
of water.
Warm water, not really hot.
A mug of icy water. So I stick my index and my ring finger in the warm water, and then my middle finger in the cold water.
Yeah. Are you starting to feel as though the middle finger is quite uncomfortably stinging hot?
Oh, that's quite... Yeah, that's quite a thing, actually.
Is it a bit painful?
Yeah, it is, yeah. No, I can keep it in there. I can keep it in there, but it's...
I'm inflicting pain on the podcast.
Yeah, no, it's definitely painful. Take it out now, actually. No, that's weird. That's weird. It didn't feel cold.
No, the thing is, it definitely doesn't feel cold.
But if I put my... Hold on, I'm just going to put my other finger... Okay, so if I put I'm putting the index finger of my left hand in there now, into just the frozen water, and that's freezing. No doubt about it.
The thing that this illusion illustrates is that your brain doesn't just simply process the sensations individually from your fingers. It somehow treats them relative to each other, and in some cases it almost does a summation over the three fingers. And right. So because your middle finger's in the middle of where it would kind of feel a peak of warm sensation, it sort of treats it like that. Now, the new thing about this paper is it's looking at what happens if you cross your fingers over. And we can't do this. With mugs of water. But they had thermal pads attached to the fingers that allowed them to do it. And they showed that when you crossed your middle finger over the index, so it was on the outside, the illusion disappeared. So you didn't have that feeling anymore. But I think perhaps what's even more interesting is that they were able to bring back the illusion if they then made the index finger, which is now in the middle, if you've got a mental picture of it, if you made that one the cold one and the other two the hot ones, then it was your index finger that had this burning sensation.
Oh, right, okay.
And what that shows is that it's the finger's position in space, not its sequence, on your hand, that your brain uses to kind of carry out these summations and comparisons between the different things your fingers are feeling. I suppose the important thing that they're saying in the paper is that that pain sensation that you get, which I think they produced more successfully probably even than we did just now, that you can manipulate that by the position your finger is in space because of the way your brain processes these feelings. It might be something that would help you if you sort of smacked your finger with a hammer or trapped it in a door. But perhaps more importantly, they're hoping that it could help people with chronic pain conditions who have continual pain in particular parts of the body. And they're hoping that they could come up with exercises that people could do to try and reduce those feelings just by moving their different parts of the body around.
I don't know whether this is saying that the pain is almost created in the brain from certain signals that are interpreted in a certain way, and you can fool it to not interpreting them in that way if the picture doesn't make sense, or quite what's happening there. But it does sound as if there might be some opportunity there for doing what you're saying in terms of relieving pain that is being almost magnified in people.
Yeah, so I think it gives a glimpse of what a complex issue pain is, and that it's not simply a wire going from your finger to your brain that is either on or off. It's something that lots of different things can affect, and hopefully we could harness some of those things for patients who've got these long-term pain conditions to help them.
There you go. And you can try that at home, but I just wouldn't use really hot water because then you'll just obviously burn yourself. But it's a fun one to try. And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to David J. Linden and Hannah Devlin. From me and all the science team, thanks for listening.